Oh, you want me to start? Am I going to just start from now on?
Yeah, okay. That's what we were doing.
Okay, cool. I was like double checking in my, well, I wasn't double checking. I was double guessing.
Yeah.
In my head on the way over here. Okay, cool. So let's try again. You are listening to A Scary State, and this week we're talking about Iowa. So, Lauren?
Yes, Kenzie?
Let's get scary.
That reminded me of in, like, drama when we go, scene. Because you're like, rrr.
Okay. I have two things to tell you.
Oh.
One does not have anything to do with the other, but they both happened today.
Okay.
So, the first thing is not really anything crazy, just more of, like, traumatic for me.
Oh.
So the company my dad works for is like helping with the passport online renewal thing.
I saw your thingy.
So because my dad like is working with them, they asked like if they had friends or family that wanted to be part of the beta testing. I said, yes, please. That'd be great.
I'll help.
Okay. And
my passport expires soon.
Mine was already expired, so I definitely needed it. So I'm on, like, the call thing and, you know, go through it, give my feedback, whatever. But when you're doing the application, whatever you want to call it, and it gets to the attributes, and I, you know, I had my height, I had my eyes, and then I got to my hair. And I was like, oh, my God, I have to officially identify as someone with brown hair.
Oh, my gosh, that's so exciting.
It was not exciting. I was so sad. I was like, I cannot cry in front of all these strangers. This is the saddest thing I've ever done. Because I'm like, I don't consider myself a blonde, but I wouldn't say I'm a brunette, even though I fully am.
Yeah, no, I don't know what I would, like, classify you as anymore.
And, you know, instead of having an old soul, I have a blonde soul. It was so heartbreaking. I was like, oh my God, it's like officially over.
And when people see the tears in your eyes, you're like, I'm fine.
I'm fine. Don't worry about it.
What if someone had pink hair? Are you able to put like pink?
Honestly, I didn't look that long. I really just clicked and moved on. I didn't want to think about it too hard.
Or you would have a breakdown.
Like brown. Just
there is nothing wrong with us brown haired people.
Yeah, but better. I'm only brown because I can't afford to be a blonde anymore. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it looks great.
It does look great.
It just, this doesn't match this.
But it looks so good.
Thank you.
It makes you look older too.
And my passport photo, you have to like take your own and I use my little selfie stick.
Oh.
And I have to say, not my license, my driver's license, but the last two passport photos I've had have been fire.
My first one looks awful.
Oh, okay. My one before I did it in high school, I chopped off my hair.
Mm.
And I looked like a boy. The only way you knew that I was a girl was because it, under gender, it said F. Oh. I will have to try to find it. I'm sure my dad still has it. But, like it's middle part hair to here. But, yeah, so that was, like, really traumatic.
That is really traumatic.
It was just – and plus, brown. Why couldn't it have been brunette? Why did it have to be brown? It's not like blonde is yellow.
Well, yeah, because blonde people don't like when their hair is described as yellow.
I don't like brunettes being brown.
It's a color.
I understand it's a color. But it's, like, the same color as dirt.
Pretty dirt. Or for some of us with darker brown hair, mud.
Yeah, but I would rather say dark brown. I feel like there's like a, I don't know, finesse to dark brown.
There is.
Versus brown.
Because then like with the brown, it could be like a mousy brown.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a Nikki Brown.
It could be.
Okay. So glad we're on the same page. So that was traumatic. But the other thing that I read this morning, did you hear about... Have you heard the story out of Kansas City?
Yep.
About those three guys?
Yep. For people who haven't heard.
Okay. So it's just on the news, but it happened at the beginning of January. There was
I didn't realize it was that long
there
ago.
It was Kansas City versus I don't remember who it was worse. Friends went over to this dude's house, watched the game. 2 days later, their loved ones are like, where the fuck are they?
Mm-hmm.
Like trying to get in contact with him, everything. Lo and behold, send police to do a welfare check. His backyard, three dead bodies, frozen to death. But he has no idea what happened.
Right.
Zero.
super suspicious.
The article I read today said that, like, the family members and things like that were saying that they messaged him, that they, like, went over to his house and were, like, banging on the door.
And didn't answer?
He didn't answer. His lawyer said for him that he was sleeping at the time and that he didn't see the messages until after the police came.
How many days from when the family was, like, okay, so you didn't look at your phone for 2 days?
Yep. So it was July 7th, I believe, was the – not July.
January.
January 7th, I believe, was the game. And then January 9th was when they were discovered.
Yeah. There's something suspicious.
But, like, the police emphasize that they're not investigating it as a homicide. It's, you know, no one's been arrested or anything like that, and they're waiting for, like, the toxicology report to come back.
Because I was talking to my coworker about it, and he said that he thinks, like, maybe they left, said bye, walked outside, or, like, had a cigarette outside or something, and were drunk and passed out. And then that's why they...
I mean, I don't know. I feel like, though, the part that makes it suspicious is that, like, you answer no one's phone call, right, or text or message of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would have been even better if you just said, oh, I don't know, they left on this day, I haven't heard from them.
Right.
That would have been less suspicious than everything you've been – you yourself have been MIA for 2 days.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's – I don't know. There's something sketch about it.
There is. There's definitely something suspicious.
He might not have necessarily done something, but I feel like he knew something.
Yeah.
I feel like he knew something.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Well, we will keep updating.
Yeah, that's fucking insane. You have 3 dead bodies in your backyard. Really? I had no idea.
How did he act when he was told?
Shocked, I suppose.
I'm supposed?
I suppose. I don't know. It just said that he really he keeps emphasizing that he has no idea. He had no idea that they were there.
Yeah.
So.
That's why women always say their friends text them when you get home.
Mm-hmm.
Which some people don't always reply.
I am always very good at it. There is only one time in recent history that I forgot.
That's why you share your location with your friends.
And I do share my location.
No, exactly.
You. You've had my location. You can check it and see where I am.
I do. When I'm like, I get into bed at night, I'm like, she should be home by now. And then I check. I'm like, okay, she's home.
Sometimes I get home and I get distracted and I just text you a little bit after I get
home.
Oh,
I know exactly how you are as a human, so I know.
As long as you know.
I do. That's
I was good the other day. I said I went to CVS first.
That is true.
So I told you why I was late. You get off work at like almost 3 o'clock and I'm like, oh my God, they're keeping her hostage.
I know. It's because we can make up our hours, so I'm working extra.
I know.
I hate it. But I like that I can make up the hours, so.
Yeah.
Because of the snow days. Mm. I'm so happy I took Friday off.
Me too. Okay. Ow.
Ow.
Ow, you won. Sorry, last interruption.
How long were you sitting on that one?
Actually just popped into my head.
That was good.
Thank you.
As the last ice age was ending, the winds blew finely ground soil into dunes along what is now the Missouri River. Dunes made of these loess.
I think it's loose.
Oh, that but would make not, a lot of sense.
I'm not sure. I'm just guessing given what's in parentheses right next to it.
So dunes made of this loose soil, from the German for loose, piled up over 200 feet in some parts of Iowa over thousands of years. Loose hills can be found elsewhere in the world, but Iowa's are special. They're second only to China's in height. Wow. The Loose Hills of western Iowa stretch 200 miles across the state into Missouri, and the Loose Hills Scenic Byway is an easy way to meander through them. See these odd-looking hills up close in Broken Kettle grasslands, a nature conservant. Why can't I say that?
It's okay. When I read it, I also tripped up over it.
Conservancy.
Because I wanted to say conservatory or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Conservancy preserve over 200 miles southwest of Des Moines. And that one's Des Moines. That one's not Des Moines.
I have Illinois in my story, and I was like, okay, hopefully I remember not to say the S.
You said it right.
Yeah, because I was thinking about it.
Oh. The Hawkeye State's greatest natural resource is its rich soil, which farmers use to grow corn and soybeans. The state's... the state's top crops. Iowa produces the most corn in the nation, and it even converts some of its corn into a fuel called ethanol. In fact, Iowa is the top U.S. producer of this energy source. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Over 200 prehistoric earthen mounds in the grounds of giant panthers, bison, deer,
wait,
and
what?
In the I don't know what.
in the shapes.
Yeah.
You said in the ground.
I know. I like, it was one of those things where I'm like, I know I said the wrong word, but I haven't tripped up yet, so I'm just going to keep going with it.
I was like, wait, where's ground?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Let's try that again. Okay. Over 200 prehistoric earthen mounds in the shapes of giant panthers, bison, deer, and other animals stand at Effigy Mounds National Monument. And see, when I was reading it, I was like, I think that's the wrong word. I'm going to keep reading to see if it makes sense.
Mounds in the ground, giant panthers.
I was like, there has to be something coming up here that will link this together.
Oh, my goodness.
The mounds are considered sacred to many Native Americans, and they may have been used by tribes as territory markers. Now, what is going on?
Now I got you feeling nervous.
I think it's too, when we were doing the recording at work, I like started to get all sweaty because they were all going to start listening to me record. And I was like, I do this every week. Why am I getting so nervous? But I like obviously couldn't tell. I'm like, I'm sweating. Oh. And then, of course, I did the mess up, and I was like, damn it, it was just a whole thing.
The sweat is getting worse.
I was like, I should be a professional right by now.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Iowa is the only state bordered by two navigable rivers, the Missouri River to the west and the Mississippi River to the east. One Iowa family farm grows enough food and fiber to feed 279 people. That is so specific. Oh. And crazy. Sergeant Charles Floyd, the only person to die during Lewis and Clark's historic journey, is buried in Sioux City. I talk about Sioux City in my story.
OMG.
Hogs outnumber people 4-1. With 3 million people in the state, that means Iowa is home to around 12 million hogs. Iowa raises nearly a third of U.S. hogs, and as a result, is the nation's number one producer of pork. Livestock has long been one of the biggest job makers in Iowa, and the pork industry is responsible for many people's livelihoods. Elkhorn is the largest Danish rural settlement in the United States. Elkhorn is home to the Danish Immigrant Museum and is known as a center of Danish ethnicity in the United States. Elkhorn is also home to the only authentic working Danish windmill in the United States. That's cool.
Right.
We should go.
Okay.
Okay. Despite being a landlocked state, Iowa has a town situated on an island. Halfway down the eastern border of Iowa lies the town of Cibola. What makes this town noteworthy is the fact that it was founded on a sandbar smack dab in the middle of the Mississippi River. This cute little town has a population of just 576 as of the 2010 census and is the state's only island town. That's kind of fun.
Yeah. It's small.
Iowa is home to the largest bike touring event in the world. Since 1973, the Register's annual Great Bike Ride across Iowa, Ragbri. That's its acronym. Has taken place covering various routes across the state. The event is sponsored by the Des Moines Register, a local newspaper, and has seen as many as 23,000 participants take part in various legs of the journey in a single year. Nowadays, the event's numbers are much more restricted, allowing just 8,500 participants. Ozzy Osbourne once chowed down on a live bat on stage in Des Moines. Gross. Mm-hmm. This unforgettable event happened on January 20th, 1982, during a Black Sabbath concert in Des Moines. A local resident called Mark Neal tossed a bat onto the stage, landing near Ozzy Osbourne. How did he, like...
They didn't give those details.
As the story goes, Ozzy believed the bat to be fake, so while in the spirit of the moment, he scooped it up and took a big bite out of it. He obviously realized his mistake within seconds and proceeded to the hospital after the show to get the rabies shot. Jeez.
Yeah.
When I did improv in college, one of the things we had to
do—you did that,
yeah—was we had to bring something that we think would scare Batman, and I like could not think of anything. So I found a Joker card and I glued like a picture of Ozzy Osbourne eating a bat on it, and like that was my like what would scare Batman. Uh-huh. And they're like, "That's genius!" And I was like, "Thank you so much."
Oh, because he's eating a bat.
Mm-hmm. Because he tore the head off a bat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good.
Oh, man. Well, that's Iowa.
Oh, my goodness. What do you pouring, Lauren?
Okay. So I have a story about a person today.
Mm.
It was a typical September day in Vinton, Iowa in 1925. Myrtle Underwood Cook was sitting at her window rehearsing a speech that she would soon be giving when an unknown assailant shot her through the heart, killing her not long after the gun was shot.
Goddamn.
For most cases that eventually go cold, it's because finding one suspect is too hard. Clues dry up, leads lead nowhere.
all that. Mm-hmm.
But in the case of Myrtle Cook, it went cold for a completely different reason. She was not a well-liked person.
So the
pool of potential subjects was more than an ocean. So before we get into that, let's get into who Myrtle Underwood Cook was. So she was born in June of 1874 in Benton County to Ensign and Martha Betty Baker.
I'm sorry. Repeat that first name for me, please.
Ensign.
Ensign?
Mm-hmm. E-N-S-I-G-N.
Ensign.
And Martha Betty Baker. They were both farmers.
No.
She had two brothers, Paul A. and Ray W. Yeah, I don't know. On July 27th, 1910, she married a man named Clifford Beeson Cook. Clifford was 26 years old. Myrtle was 36.
Okay.
They adopted a daughter named Gertrude, who had been born in 1910 in Minnesota.
Minnesota.
Some would describe Cook as a strong-minded and courageous woman who held strong onto her beliefs. Mm. But others would describe her as an overbearing, bigoted busybody.
Oh, Lord.
At 41 or 51... Reports vary.
Whatever.
Cook was a very active woman, engaged in many of the activities and groups in the local community. She lived with her 65-year-old mother-in-law, Elizabeth Cook, and her now 16-year-old daughter, Gertrude. But one person not living in this home was her husband, Clifford.
Why?
I will tell you why.
Okay.
Their marriage was strange for the time and certainly not considered normal. So Clifford hadn't lived with Myrtle and his daughter for the last 5 years, as he worked various jobs that kept him out of the home. So he worked as a truck driver for a big company and then as a traveling salesman. Mm. So all jobs that make sure you aren't home often. And if you think about it, traveling salesman is a job that literally is not like a thing anymore.
Mm-mm. Nope.
But every couple of weeks, he would stop by the house and he and Myrtle would keep in touch and correspond while he was away. He said that he and Myrtle would see each other, quote, once every fortnight and when he would come home to visit Vinton. I think a fortnight's like 2 weeks.
It's long. It's nothing to do with four that much, I know.
It's a fort. Not four night.
Yeah, but four is in there.
F-O-R.
Mm-hmm. Four. Still the same root.
Oh, my God. And then Myrtle would come visit him when he, quote, sang in the Baptist choir.
Okay.
So not exactly a strange, but not exactly what would be deemed normal.
I can think of a lot of people that would love that arrangement.
Yeah, right? So for one, Myrtle Cook was a prohibitionist, meaning she supported prohibition.
Yuck.
You were like, what? And then Iowa had been dry since 1916, well before the law actually went into effect nationwide in 1920, meaning more or less that those in Iowa had gotten pretty good at making and distributing illegal alcohol.
Good for them.
Well, this was not okay with Myrtle.
Of course not.
She was so against these illegal activities that she would give speeches to the Women's Christian Temperance Union, an organization she was a member of. She attended state events to talk about the evils of alcohol, and she even organized local women for her cause.
You know, it reminds me of the case I just did with Annie Cook, but she's like the exact opposite. Like, still a hated person, but instead of like breaking the law all the time, she's like super like, follow the law.
Yeah. When I had Cook, I was like, wait. Because you even said in that episode, you're like, a lot of bad people have the last name Cook.
Yeah, man.
Right, you're going to love this.
Okay.
She considered herself a dry crusader and waged a war against John Barleycorn. So John Barleycorn is actually the name of a personification of barley and of alcoholic drinks made from it, so beer and whiskey. So she was a dry crusader.
For an imaginary figure.
Well, against him.
Right.
Yeah. She would learn the name of those involved in these illegal alcohol things. She would copy down the license plate numbers of cars that she was suspicious of.
Snitch!
Cars that she thought were rum running. She kept careful notes of all the goings-on in Vinton. She would also keep an eye on all of her suspicious neighbors, ones who she thought were still drinking alcohol, though it was now illegal. She would bring her claims and her suspicions to the local police, demanding that they look into every single person that she had her suspicions about.
She would have been a fucking bitch during the witch trials.
Yeah, she would have. She'd be like, you want me to tell you all the witches here? And actually, because of all of her suspicions and talking to the police, she did manage to be responsible for the arrests of many bootleggers.
We don't condone breaking the law, but sometimes when laws are stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. Fellow prohibitionists praised her and considered her a hero, but most residents in Vinton saw her as, quote, a meddler and a disagreeable gossip.
I was thinking, this is not as fun as my other thoughts, but I wonder if, like, there were so many women against it because of their probably abusive fathers, husbands, or whatever, who drank a lot. Which,
maybe.
Like, I can understand. Mm-hmm. I get where they're coming from. But that's more of a psychological issue that they're going to have to work on.
Exactly. But then we also have those who wanted to drink or provide alcohol in peace, but they didn't – so those people didn't like her. But even those who didn't drink did not support the prosecution of those who did.
Good for them.
So I guess that doesn't sound like too awful, just your typical Karen being a complete nuisance.
That's a problem enough.
But now this is where it gets really bad.
Uh-oh.
So Cook was also the head of the Benton County Women's Branch of the Ku Klux Klan. I know. Right. When I read that part, too, I was like, I'm sorry.
It's going to be – I will
So apparently it was puzzling to many how someone would be part of the Women's Christian Temperance Unit Union, but also the KKK.
Yeah.
But in 1925, it was acceptable and even desirable. And believe it or not, the two groups shared some goals. So I got this from a website, so this is in quotes. Quote, upholding prohibition, wiping out bootlegging and alcohol consumption, ensuring the traditional home, promoting patriotism, advancing Protestantism, and agitating against foreigners, whom they considered a negative influence because of their Catholic and Jewish faith and their purported fondness for alcohol. End quote.
I mean, I can't speak for the Catholic, especially if they're Irish. But
yeah, your bad beliefs and your fondness for alcohol.
Jesus turned water into wine.
Bitch. Yeah. And then the Women's Christian Temperance Union, I don't know why I keep wanting to say unit, union. I looked them up a little bit. They were also very against like alcohol, and they would raise. So when they had a child, like a baby, one of the women had a baby, they would tie a white ribbon around their wrist for like purity. Mm-hmm. And then they would raise the child throughout life to never experience drugs and alcohol. Which is, like, kind of good-ish, if you think about it in that sort of way. But it's just the way that they go about it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So the whole pushing your beliefs, you know, separation of church and state people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
You don't have to drink if you don't want to. But if I want to get belligerent, leave me alone.
Mm-hmm. My body, my choice.
Oh, are we upset because someone is telling you what you can and cannot do?
Oh,
my God.
Jeez. So let's go back to the beginning. So it was September 7th, 1925. A horrible storm was rolling outside, and Cook sat in the house right next to her window working on a speech. She was president of the local chapter of the WCTU, mm-hmm. that union, and tomorrow she would be talking to the union at their meeting. Part of her speech read, quote, to say America cannot enforce prohibition is to do violence to America's tradition and to underestimate the American spirit. American willpower has turned apparent impossibilities into wondrous achievements. We need women who are unafraid, just as our mothers, women who believe in God and home and country, women who stand for purity and truth. A strong united sisterhood will reinstate the old-fashioned religion in our schools and over the land. Friends, are we afraid to take up the burden? But it is hard for someone to keep on the firing line all the time. Others must put their shoulders to the wheel. Let us pray that every Christian woman will enlist.
Mm.
As she was riding away, someone crept up to her living room window and fired a gun. It hit Cook directly in the heart, and she died less than an hour later. Her mother-in-law, Elizabeth, had been home that night, upstairs in her room. She could hear the storm outside, and she could hear Cook practicing her speech downstairs. Elizabeth then heard what she thought was thunder, followed by silence.
Yeah, I bet she did.
No more reading from Cook. That is when she headed downstairs to see why it was silent. There she saw Cook on the floor, gasping and bleeding from her chest.
Yeah! That's so gross.
That would be terrifying.
Yeah.
Elizabeth then must have alerted authorities because she told them that right before Cook died, she had named who her killer was.
What?
Elizabeth gave the name to authorities, but they immediately dismissed the claim. The man Cook had named was a businessman of high regard, one who couldn't possibly be seen as an assassin.
Of course.
Police believed that if she had actually named this name, because they didn't hear it,
uh-huh.
that it was just a case of mistaken identity.
Uh-huh.
But police did jump to investigating her murder pretty quickly. The state offered a $500 reward for information on the case, and the WCTU offered a $200 reward. A lot of authority personnel showed up to help with the case as well. Governor Hamill became involved after Myrtle's mother-in-law, Elizabeth, claimed that Vinton had not supported any of Myrtle's anti-alcohol efforts, which was a bad look for the town in the midst of Prohibition.
Sure.
So he jumped in immediately.
Yeah.
Benton County Attorney J. David Nichols and Sheriff Whitfield Rule joined in on the investigation, as well as James E. Risden, chief of the Iowa Bureau of Criminal Investigation, and a few agents representing Des Moines law enforcement. Police immediately first thought that the suspect was one of the many, many bootleggers that Cook had sent to prison at some point.
I mean, fair.
Overall, they ended up, like, interrogating 27 witnesses or suspects in different closed sessions.
Jeez.
But
started to get their main suspects. So the first main suspect that popped into their mind was Harold Ponder.
What? Ponder.
Yeah. He was a huge figure in a local and very prominent liquor ring. His acquaintances described him as lame brain, dingbat, and blabbermouth.
So stupid.
Yeah, so not good things. You don't want to be called any of those. And he was no stranger to the law, having been locked up quite a few times already. He had been locked up and was serving a sentence in the Fort Madison Penitentiary for stealing a car, but conveniently, just 3 weeks before Cook's murder, he had escaped the penitentiary. And he had been seen in Vinton just before and after the murder had taken place.
Hmm.
The police's theory was that he had killed her, trying to make it seem like a different liquor ring was carrying out the murder to get that rival ring busted.
Okay.
He was captured in October for the murder, but was eventually released after authorities were unable to find any solid evidence to actually link him to the murder.
Yeah.
Another source said he disappeared when authorities started suspecting him, never to be seen again.
Hmm.
I think I go more with this one, though, because, like, if he escaped jail and the police capture you,
right,
why are they just going to let you go?
There's another reason you should be in there.
Exactly. They would probably just bring you back to jail.
Exactly.
Many who believe it was Ponder said, quote, "In due time, it came to be believed that after doing this job, he had been disposed of by the persons who hired him to avoid any possibility that they might be implicated by the blabbermouth."
What year is this?
1925.
It seemed a little early for espionage.
But yeah, they're like, kill this lady and then kill you. So just 4 days after the murder, four young boys were arrested as interests, with one of those young men being the son of a prominent state senator.
Mm-mm.
They had egged Cook's house just 2 months earlier on July 4th.
Yes, I see the direct correlation between egging and escalation to murder.
Right.
Makes sense.
I know. That's what I thought of, too. I was like, should I mention all the times we egged people?
Were we on the path to homicide and we didn't know it?
My favorite was still the time when our one friend was driving us around and our other friend was holding all the eggs outside of a house. And the one friend honked the horse and the other one threw the eggs up when she jumped. And then he drove away and we had to run after the car.
Oh, I still don't think I've ever laughed so hard in my life.
That was so funny.
Oh, it was amazing.
And then, do you remember, and I don't know if other people experienced this, but there was a time when we were out of the whole egging situation,
mm-hmm,
that you were not allowed to buy eggs at the grocery store. We once went to the grocery store legitimately to buy, I think it was like me and Jesse. We went to go buy, I swear you had to have been with us. There was never a time when the three of us weren't together.
There was lots of times the three of us weren't together.
Barely. Anyway, so we went to the store to buy brownies. And so we got
that
brownies, butter.
I was there for that. I was not there. I was at her house.
Right. So brownies, butter, eggs, all the stuff.
Yes.
And the lady ringing us up was like, we can't sell you the eggs. And we're like, what?
Yes.
And she's like, yeah, too many people have been egging recently. And we're like, we're buying this to make brownies. Like,
the
what?
One time we're honest. In all fairness, I don't remember us ever buying eggs and then going.
No!
I feel like we just took the eggs we had.
Yeah. So Cook believed that these boys had been hired by some bootleggers in order to intimidate her. And it actually did intimidate her. She once told a friend, quote, "This work may be the end of me yet."
No. Oh.
But just like Ponder, there was nothing to implicate them in the murder. Then we have Charlie Parafield. He was another suspect who was interviewed as well. He had gotten drunk on Labor Day and had made vague threats while he was intoxicated. He refused to say anything to the coroner's jury, which I'll touch on in a bit what that is. But no one believed he was guilty, so he too was crossed off the list of suspects.
Okay.
So next, of course, the police turned their attention to Cook's husband, Clifford Beeson Cook. Clifford was a former member of the Iowa National Guard, but he and Myrtle.
What a slip of the tongue.
Oh, I know. Living apart began when he picked up a job as a long-distance drayman. He hauled gravel at Osage and St. Ansgar. So a drayman is just someone who moves dray and gravel. Then he worked as a salesman for the American Monument Works at the Gas and Electric Company in Waverly and Sioux City. And it was in Sioux City, 6 weeks before Cook's murder, where Clifford joined the KKK. At the time that Cook had been murdered, Clifford was living in a rooming house in Sioux City. But according to Clifford, he had actually lost his job in the city and was unable to find work. So he packed himself up and headed back to Vinton on September 6th, so just one day before the murder.
Mm-hmm.
But the roads were slippery that day due to the thunderstorm rolling through. So he spent the night of September 7th in a hotel in Grundy Center, which was some 50 miles from Vinton.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he arrived home the next day to find the front door covered in crepe and flowers. I looked up what crepe was, and it's actually pretty interesting. So back in Victorian times, which obviously a lot of that stuff runs into current times.
Sure.
After someone died, the family of the deceased would drape crepe down the sides of the front door in order to cover the knocker or doorbell in a way to prevent visitors from disturbing the family inside.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. So visitors who were aware of the death were to either knock quietly or enter the home if the door had been left ajar.
Okay.
So Clifford arrives at the house and sees this. His first thought was that his mother, Elizabeth, had finally died. Mm. His daughter runs out to him when she sees him, sobbing, crying, "Oh, Daddy, Mama is gone." Clifford is obviously brought in and questioned, and pretty quickly, detectives started to pick up on the fact that he was having a hard time keeping his story straight.
Mm.
One of those contradictions was that under oath, he told the coroner's jury that he had no female acquaintances in Sioux City.
Liar!
Yup. But that soon changed when he then said that he had actually been spending the day, September 7th, so the day his wife died, with a woman named Hester Sealing, a woman he later went on to marry. Hester Sealing was also questioned about her relationship with Clifford and where he was on the night of Myrtle's murder, in a way to either verify or tear apart his alibi. Clifford's lawyer tried to deal with this new affair coming to light by saying that he may have been an unfaithful husband, but he wasn't a murderous one.
I mean...
And the police were unable to prove otherwise. Mm. But there would have been no outright motive for Clifford either. So Cook didn't have a life insurance policy. Mm. So there would have been no financial gain from her death.
Okay.
Out of the two of them, Clifford was actually the only one who had a life insurance policy on himself. Mm. So her dying does nothing.
Doesn't, yeah.
Clifford, fully aware of his wife's feelings on prohibition and whatnot, tried to say that some of his wife's many enemies had probably hired a hitman to take her out. But that claim was never looked into.
Yeah.
The coroner's jury came back, and they said that they could not say who shot Cook, but they did recommend that the police keep a close eye on her husband, Clifford.
Hmm.
So, side note, Britannica.com says a coroner's jury is, quote, a group summoned from a district to assist a coroner in determining the cause of a person's death.
Hmm.
The coroner's jury resembles the grand jury in that it does not try cases, but rather reviews evidence that may be relevant at a trial. The jury's verdict states how, when, and where the deceased died. If the jury concludes that the deceased died by murder or manslaughter, it can name suspects, and the coroner can order arrest and detainment pending grand jury action.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. The verdict of a coroner's jury is admissible only as evidence of the fact of death, which is occasionally an issue in cases of mass accidents or deaths in which the bodies are difficult to identify.
Mm.
So it seems like this was their only, like, jury that they were using was, like, this coroner's jury. It never talked about a grand jury. It never talked about, like, a big trial. It was just kind of the coroner's jury. And although he wasn't charged with murder, Clifford was charged instead with perjury for giving conflicting testimony at the coroner's inquest concerning his private life in Sioux City, the timing of his wife's murder, and his assistance that his wife had whispered her killer's name as she died.
Hmm.
It has never been found out what happened to Cook or who was responsible, but we have a few theories, most of which we went over, such as a hitman, one of the many bootleggers who she helped imprison, one of the many neighbors who hated the KKK, which she was part of. One of the many neighbors she annoyed with her prohibition beliefs.
There was a lot of reasons for this bitch to die.
Many, many theories. Vinton judge John W. Tobin said in his 1986 book, Tobin Tales, that he believes Cook's shooting was accidental. So he said that her home was near railroad tracks. Tracks that were a popular hangout for, quote, drunks, drug addicts, and other undesirables. He suggested that maybe someone was trying to shoot someone else and accidentally hit Cook instead.
I mean... I guess.
Yeah. He also said in his book that a salesman testified that he saw Clifford in a Grundy Center hotel on the night of Cook's murder, thereby corroborating Clifford's previously provided alibi.
Mm-hmm.
More so, which pushed Tobin to believe that it wasn't her husband, but rather a random accidental shooting.
Okay.
When you have so many enemies, I don't know.
Right. It's hard.
Myrtle Underwood Cook's funeral was held on September 10th, 1925, at the Methodist Episcopal Church in Vinton. It had to actually be moved to this church from the smaller one she, like, typically went to because so many people were in attendance and this church was larger.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole town actually shut down for 2 whole days because so many people in the town attended.
Like, spite or, like, sadness?
I'm not sure. Know? I was kind of thinking the same thing. I was like, did people go because they were sad or did people go to, like, really prove that she was dead? So Knights of the KKK attended Cook's funeral.
Mm.
They literally lined the sidewalk where her casket was taken. The new minister of the church, who had agreed to let the funeral be held there, stated that he, quote, was unaware of what he was getting into when he agreed to allow the funeral to be held at his church. And this kind of seems true, though, because the Reverend Clarence Kleckner had just moved to Vinton 3 days prior.
Damn.
So these people were like, hey, can we have this, like, big funeral at your church? And he's like, yeah, of course, not knowing it was KKK.
That reminds me of the Friends episode when Ross moves in to that new apartment and someone is leaving and they're, like, expecting him to, like, give
tip
for the gift or whatever.
And then everyone hates him.
Yeah. Same vibes.
The preacher who officiated the funeral of Myrtle Cook dressed in the iconic white robes that the KKK are known for wearing.
Bro.
His name was Reverend A.A. Wright, and he was actually a Klan leader.
A.A. Ron.
At her funeral, Wright praised Cook for her work with the Woman's Christian Temperance Union and all of her efforts during Prohibition. He announced that Cook had held the highest office in the other organization she had been a part of, the Women of the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Wright compared Cook to Jesus Christ in her suffering.
Oh, my Lord.
He then compared her to George Washington in her patriotism. He said, quote, "She was the personification of true Americanism and represented these deep instincts and qualities of our race, which has led us to high achievements."
The blind confidence that these people have is astounding.
Uh-huh.
Just phenomenal.
And what's interesting is they're very racist, as we know, the KKK.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, like, comparing her to Jesus. But if we go off of where Jesus actually came from and what his actual skin color would look like, yeah. I don't think they would like him.
No, absolutely not. And they don't like all Jewish-loving people. They want to get rid of Catholics.
Right, right.
And I'm like, it's all the same thing. It really is just all the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So he went on to suggest that Cook had been murdered because of her opposition to bootleggers. That was her downfall.
Yeah, sure.
All of those who attended were clothed in their iconic white robes.
God!
Women's Christian Temperance Union members and their world president, Anna Adams Gordon, all wore white robes embroidered with flaming red crosses.
That's like when we say World Series or like World Champions for the Super Bowl. And I'm like, with World who? It is just us playing this game.
Right. While Cook was being laid in her grave at Evergreen Cemetery, a cross was set on fire at the head of it. Which also goes against the Women's Christian Temperance Union. I don't know. But the KKK was big into burning crosses, so.
Okay.
People still didn't like the Klan, though, which is good, both for their racial and religious views, but also for their stance on prohibition. But they especially didn't like this whole spectacle that went on for Cook's funeral. The night of her funeral, two men wearing caps and handkerchiefs over their faces broke into the house of Reverend Kleckner, the one who had just moved into town. The Reverend wasn't home, but his wife, Lula, she's cute, she was. The men interrogated her, asking her if the Reverend was a member of the Klan, as he too had been at the funeral. The men left as Lula alerted the authorities. Authorities arrived at the Kleckner household with bloodhounds, who followed the men's trail for 2 miles until they lost it. This is where it's believed that the men had escaped in a car. Rain had also washed away any additional tracks or footprints, so they kind of had nothing to go on.
If you're a part of something and you have to cover your face...
Well, they thought he was part of the Klan, so they came to, like, be mad at him because he was part of the Klan. That's why they covered their faces.
Wearing Klan stuff.
No.
Oh.
No, they had on normal caps, not KKK caps.
Okay.
No, they were mad that he was supposedly part of the Klan.
Oh, sorry. I was thinking the opposite.
Yeah, so she had to tell them pretty much, like, no, we just moved here. We had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
One newspaper would later report on the incident and describe Lula Kleckner as, quote, in serious physical condition as the result of the intrusion and the shock it caused, and said that she had been troubled with a nervous complaint and had been allowed to sit up for a short time each day. So it makes me feel, I don't know what that means, but I took it as, like, maybe she got hurt in the whole situation, and so she was, like, hospitalized and was, like, slowly starting to get her strength back up.
I guess so. Definitely sounds weird.
I know. But that was in quotes from, like, one of the things, so.
Yeah.
From October 27th through October 30th of 1925, the Woman's Christian Temperance Union held a convention as a memorial to our martyred comrade, Myrtle Cook, and that the entire meeting would, quote, surely be a true inspiration to those who uphold law and order, purity, and the downfall of the liquor element. At the convention, Cook was placed in the group's pantheon of heroes.
Oh, my God.
This was alongside Reverend George Haddock, who had been Iowa's first prohibition martyr who had been murdered in 1886.
Fuck around and find out, sounds like.
A resolution was also passed petitioning the national group to hire a detective to solve Cook's murder. And though she was an awful person, something good did come from her death.
Okay.
I know that sounds really, like, sad, but.
So it is a good thing she died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this murder
for many reasons.
Yeah. So this murder obviously brought some negative publicity to the town.
Mm-hmm.
This case, with the KKK being involved, became a media circus. The news, quote, falsely depicted the town as a friendly harbor for criminals and a welcoming rendezvous for bootleggers and all other evildoers.
Mm.
That was reported all over the news. So the residents didn't like that. It, in turn, caused the residents to turn against having the KKK in their town. So I guess before they were like, they're there, but meh. Well, this, like, they were like, no. The Klan leaders were even informed that their secret meetings were not acceptable. Because they started to meet in secret, and then they were told no.
If you're meeting in secret, if you have to wear a mask to cover your face when you're doing shit, you know who also does that? A robber. You know what that is? Illegal. Bad. Not okay. Against the law. Something you shouldn't do. Interesting.
Right. So this, being told they couldn't have their secret meetings, caused the Klan to go underground, and eventually they disappeared from Vinton altogether. The residents, regardless of their stance on prohibition, also decided that the lawlessness of rum running had to end, as it was bad, it was dangerous. So many of the big liquor gangs were also run out of town, leaving Vinton a considerably more peaceful and better place. So I'm just going to put this in there because I feel like I have to. If you have any information about her unsolved murder from 1925, please contact the Vinton Police Department at 319-472-2321. So I put that this is a weird case because obviously murder is bad. It's never good. People... Most people shouldn't die. Most people don't deserve to die. I can think of like one, but most people don't deserve to die. But it's hard to feel a ton of sympathy for someone who's a member of the KKK.
Yeah, I feel like in that aspect, I'm comfortable with saying that I'm okay that she died.
Which is why when I chose this case, I was like, okay, this is a weird one because it's a murder. We don't really touch on the murder.
Yeah, and
but she's a scary person because she's part of the KKK.
Right, I don't condone the part of... you know, committing a crime, because if you condone for one, you condone for all. And so murder is murder. Mm-hmm. Howsomever.
I love when you say that.
Am I going to feel sadness for someone who was a terrible person? No. You know, there are people who should just be dead. It'd be better for everybody else if they were. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean I think anyone should do anything about it unless, you know, a spiritual being wants to come down and natural causes take over, then who am I to judge? But human to human, yeah, we can't go around doing that.
Right.
But, you know, kind of good riddance at the same time.
She also looks like a total Karen if you look at pictures of her. But yeah, and apparently Iowa had, like, a really, really bad KKK problem, like, during this whole time. Because when I would type in her name, I would get articles of, like, Ku Klux Klan in Iowa. Bad, blah, blah, blah. And then I would search her name, and she would be listed in the article of the Klan in Iowa.
So what's interesting about that is that one of the facts that I was going to include is about the fact that Iowa really supported the Civil War, but the Union side...
Oh.
And they actually sent, like, one of the most amount of people from their state versus any other state at the time.
Because, yeah, they are kind of north.
Yeah. Huh. Like, they supported the Union.
Right.
I feel like a lot of people must have just gone up.
Yeah. It was a lot from Benton County. I don't know where in Iowa Benton County was. I think it's more towards, like, the nose part of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Yeah, this part gets a little tricky of what side they're going to be on.
It does. It does. Because where does the Mason-Dixon line go?
We're below it, so I think it's somewhere by...
Did it go all the way over here, or did it just stay over in our area?
I think it's just over here.
Oh. Look at me thinking I was making a really big connection.
Oh, you're thinking if it went that way, then Iowa would be above.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's why we have West Virginia, because when Virginia joined the Confederacy, West Virginia was like, uh-uh.
Right.
Which, again, is weird.
Right.
How far we've come.
But yeah, so that's Myrtle Underwood Cook.
Wow.
Yeah.
Myrtle was murdered.
I know. That was a weird slip of the tongue there.
Wowza. Yeah, that's definitely a tricky one for one's moral compass.
Exactly. Because, like, yeah, I don't condone murder, but, like, and your death did bring about getting the KKK and the, like, bad people out of your town.
If someone bad died or got murdered and I knew who it was... I'm not going to say anything.
Nora covered a case. I think it was our first Missouri episode. I can't remember the guy's name, but he was pretty much shot dead in the middle of the street, surrounded by his town. Every single person in the town knew who pulled that trigger, but no one said anything, and it has been unsolved ever since. Because he was the worst person in the town. He was, like, violent, abusive, sexually assaulting people, a robber, like, awful. And so the cops were like, we know you all saw who did it. And they're like, yeah. And they're like, so who did it? They said, I don't know. I didn't see anything.
That would be me.
And that is, I feel like, you know, probably with this case or similar to this case.
I don't know who did it.
Yeah. Exactly.
One me.
So yeah, if you want to hear that, go listen to our first Missouri episode. All right, Mackenzie, what story do you got?
Like we have complained before, sometimes you go look into something and there isn't much about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or the website that could give you a lot more information changes to some Russian website when you click on anything. So today's theme is more spiritual than spooky.
Okay.
More ESP than OMG. I thought that was so funny when you wrote it. I was like, she's gonna roll her eyes.
No, you gotta chuckle.
So, the Vincent House was built in 1872 by James and Adeline Swain, one of the first pioneer families to settle in Fort Dodge. I love the name Adeline.
I do too.
Oh, my gee. During their time in the house, Adeline dedicated herself to educating women. She taught higher education in English, French, botany, oil painting, and drawing. Adeline Swain was the first woman in Iowa to lead the women's rights movement. According to the current caretaker of the home, Dan Prochaska, Susan B. Anthony stayed at the house and helped start the suffrage rally in the area.
Oh, wow.
Prochaska also says that Adeline was a member of the movement to find an end to the locust plague that hit in the 1870s.
Oh.
He said, quote, she had secret governmental meetings here, and she actually found a way to help end that.
Wow.
The Swains rented out rooms in the home to newcomers arriving in Fort Dodge. During the 8 years they lived there, the Swains rented out the house for banquets, parties, receptions, and other events. Notable people were in attendance at the Swains' parties, such as the late A.H. Hilton of the Hilton Hiltons.
Oh, wow.
And his future wife, Mary G. Lauferswiller. Hilton would later marry Mary. And moved to Texas to lay the foundation for what would become one of the biggest and most well-known hotel chains in the world.
And is Paris Hilton, like, part of Hilton?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Wow.
So this would have been her great, great grandfather, I believe.
Oh, wow.
I think his son is the one who kind of goes off and makes Hilton Hilton.
Okay.
Yeah. And so then I think the dad is after, and then Paris.
That would make sense. Yes, yeah. How generations tend to go.
Yeah, I think. I'm not 100% sure. Her dad could be a million years old. I don't know. In the late 70s, the spiritualist movement became popular and caught the attention of the Swains. The spiritualists believed that they could communicate with the dead and equality for humanity, especially gender.
Do you think you and I would have been spiritualists at this time?
100%.
I think so, too.
For sure.
Communicating with the dead and everyone should be equal.
Yes.
Okay.
This especially appealed to Adeline Swain. The Swains formed a little community of followers and would hold seances on the third floor, which was considered the ballroom.
Oh.
In 1879, Adeline Swain had to sell the home after James's death because of financial hardship. Webb and Catherine Vincent bought the home in October of that year, but the house wasn't completely finished. The couple had two children, Helen and Donald. Helen passed away as a young child, not sure of the reason. The Vincent son, Donald, was playing on the floor between the dining room and the parlor when he fell into the heating register since the grates hadn't been installed yet.
Oh.
Donald suffered a broken arm.
Oh. I thought that was how he died.
I know. Because when I read it, that's the same reaction that I had. I was like, oh my God. And then I read the next one. I was like, oh, he's fine.
Well, thank God.
I know.
So I was thinking, what a way to go.
Oh, I'm so glad you reacted that way. That's
great. Why'd you look out?
Oh, I just noticed that it was more open.
Oh God, don't do that. Mackenzie, like, we're in our studio, and we have the curtain covering the door, like, slightly open so Roy can go in and out, and she just does this really creepy, like, slow look over and then just turns back and, like, what?
Sorry. La, 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 la. One source I read said, when the stock market crashed in 1929, Charles Vincent, I don't know who this kid is. I have no idea. He's not a spouse of anyone I could find.
Who, Charles?
Not a cousin. As far as I knew, dad's name was Webb. So, I don't know who this Charles guys is. I know I said that weird. But somehow he has a relationship with the family, and he shot himself in the ballroom.
Oh!
Yeah.
So that death you just quickly gloss over.
Yeah, well, because I'm like, what the fuck is this guy? Donald Vincent's wife, Anne, and their daughter, Catherine Deerdorf, approached the YMCA and asked if they were interested in acquiring the house. They said they would love to, but they didn't have the funds to do so. In 1969, Anne Vincent willed the home to the YMCA under the caveat that the house was preserved, and along with the trust fund set up by Anne and her daughter, the house be officially named Vincent House and be used by the public.
Oh.
In 1973, the house was placed on the National Register of Historic Places, and today the house is available for rent for all sorts of get-togethers, continuing the home's reputation of a social center like it was in the late 1800s.
That's cool.
So the caretaker of the Vincent home, our man, Dan Proshaka, told the Messenger that he has had several encounters that lead him to believe that there are spirits in the home. Prochaska said that when a psychic medium visited the house, oh, what's funny is that when I was first writing this, it autocorrected to psycho. So when I was reading over my notes.
A psycho medium.
When a psychic medium visited the house, she said that there were close to 25 spirits that resided in the home.
Jeez.
Among these spirits were James and Adeline Swain. The psychic also said that when there were parties at the home or when someone is playing the piano, the spirits will come to the staircase and are dressed in period clothing, just wanting to know what's going on.
Oh.
A lot of people believe that because of the seances that they held. That they opened something. Yeah.
Because I was about to ask, do you think this is like your theory with the mansion I covered last week where you were like, you know, like, why do you think all these random spirits are there? Like, do you think it's like a welcome here home thing kind of thing?
Like a halfway house for spirits.
Right, yeah.
Well, this one, they had a bunch of seances.
That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. So side note, in another interview with the Messenger, Prochaska was describing the kind of services that one could expect if they rented out the house for like a special event.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he would occasionally play the piano for guests. And I'm like, before or after the psychic medium came?
Yeah, exactly.
You know? But apparently it's the original piano that was purchased by the Vincents for their daughter Helen in 1885.
Oh, that's cool.
Prochaska says that the ghost of Helen Vincent is quite active. He told the Messenger, quote, I was showing the house to a couple to be married. They were in the living room. I was in the dining room. Sidebar, the house is beautiful.
Because when you kept saying, like, events and stuff, I was wondering, like, do we mean weddings?
It is a beautiful home.
Oh, okay.
It is a beautiful home. So you can do it for, like, people talk about graduations they've gone to, different kinds of parties. Like,
wow.
It, even the outside, when you look at the pictures, it's a very, very pretty home. So it's not like people are going to get married in some creepy old haunted house.
Right. The creepy haunted house up on the hill.
Right, exactly. Quote, I was showing the house to a couple to be married. They were in the living room. I was in the dining room. All of a sudden, I heard them gasp. I turned around, and all three of us saw this. We saw a little girl dressed in black. She ran around the piano, waved at us, and disappeared.
Oh, no.
Oh, it gets creepier.
Our house is already, like, really cold because we turn off the heat when we record, and now I'm getting even more goosebumps.
I, like, when I get to part of this, I'm tempted to, like, turn my little flashlight on. It's a creepy ghost story. During a Halloween tour, there was a group of people dressed in historical clothing impersonating the Vincent family, including a young girl portraying Helen. The last group of people on one of the late night tours were upstairs when the little girl walked by them and went back downstairs. Prochaska said that when they were cleaning up, he mentioned how much he enjoyed the little girl's performance of Helen. The people who he was talking to were confused and asked him when this happened. Turns out the little girl playing Helen had gone home hours prior to the last group, so it couldn't have been her that walked by.
Gross.
One evening, one of the hostesses at Vincent House could hear noises coming from the second floor. This noise was creepy enough to make her want to leave. When Prochaska arrived at the house, the woman was standing down the block. He somehow convinced her to come back inside, and they walked up the back staircase to the second floor. In the children's room, a hairbrush that usually sits on the dresser had been thrown onto the floor. Prochaska put the hairbrush back on the dresser, turned off the lights, and locked the door.
As one does.
He told the Messenger, quote, we no sooner got outside and one of the lights upstairs came on.
Oh, no.
I went back in, up the stairs to shut the lights off. And I said, that is enough. And the light never came back on again that night. Prochaska says the lights turn on randomly all the time. Once he caught on film the chandelier twisting and turning.
Oh.
Supposedly, when you drive by the Vincent house, you might see handprints form on the windows of the ballroom on the third floor.
Yeah,
I didn't like that one either.
Mm-mm.
The researchers in paranormal phenomenon, or RIPP, investigated the house for only a few hours, but what they experienced makes them want to come back for more.
Ooh.
The one who kind of retells the story. Her name is Jeanette the Nupacorn.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The Noopicorn.
The Noopicorn.
That's fun.
Yeah. Better than the last one.
I was just going to say that too. Was it something porn cocks?
Wheelie porn cocks.
Yep.
I pray to God that I said that wrong and just looked like a total ass because that just.
But that's what the person on TV said.
It is what the person on TV said, but he's most definitely a white man, so.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
He most likely screwed it up.
Probably.
So the Noopicorn was the leader of the group and reported, quote, "We were standing around the kitchen island and we noticed the room got brighter. No one was near the light switch. In fact, I did not find the light switch until we went home that night. Somehow the light switch got flipped on. That is a big deal. Movements and things like that seem to require a lot of energy." The ghost hunting group gathered, equipped with their ghost hunting gear, for a spine-chilling investigation. Despite not bringing all their equipment, they set up recorders to capture the mysterious occurrences throughout the house. The Noopicorn said, quote, "My brand new batteries kept going dead. That was pretty frustrating. Something was draining my batteries. I put a recorder on the piano and it went dead. Why? I don't know, but the recorder I was holding had the same new battery and it didn't go dead. And it's still going strong, and other devices with batteries from the same pack worked. But three batteries drained like nothing." This supernatural phenomenon was not new to the Noopicorn, who encountered a similar eerie incidences in previous ghost investigations. As they explored the haunted mansion's second floor, they ventured into the middle room, where legend spoke of indentations appearing on the bed even after straightening the bedding.
Ew.
Yeah. The Noopicorn said, quote, "We smoothed out the bed, and when we came back, the depressions reappeared on the bed. Was it something? Is it an old mattress? We don't know." Before ascending to the ominous ballroom, the Noopicorn strategically placed a recorder in one of the second floor bedrooms. She also decided to push a rod filled with clothing that once belonged to the Vincents into the closet and shut the door.
Why?
I have no idea.
Huh.
Listening to the recorder later, she discovered audible movements, not just typical house creaks, but definite ghostly motions. The first sound was a mysterious bump, followed by movement and footsteps, then another bump and more footsteps. A sliding noise resembling someone pulling the rod of clothing in and out was unmistakable.
Oh.
But it was still in there when she checked. In the ballroom, the group hoped to make contact with Charles Vincent, the mansion's tragic suicide victim. As they used their equipment and asked probing questions, including, "Can you tell us, is anybody here?" they were met with an unsettling silence. The Noopicorn recounted, quote, "We asked Charles, are you here? All of a sudden, clear as a bell, we heard, no." "We asked if he could touch this device, and once again, no." Strange movements echoed in the background. Yet the most spine-chilling moment of the night was when the group asked who they were talking to and how many spirits were present. The Noopicorn said, quote, "Clear as a bell, it said, get out. We all heard it." Following that warning, part of the group heeded the ghostly command and fled. However, three brave souls, including the Noopicorn, remained. Undeterred, they set up in the parlor and summoned the unseen by asking if anyone was present. The Noopicorn reported, quote, "I got two knocks. I said, if that was you, could you do it again? I got two more knocks." The recorder captured an unsettling giggle, perhaps the mischievous spirit of Helen Vincent playing tricks.
No.
Undeterred by the paranormal, the Noopicorn attempted once more to unveil the ghostly presence, saying, quote, "I asked if Mr. Vincent was there, and we recorded the sound of a sigh of disgust or like a clearing of a throat." Dan Prochaska told the messenger that he hoped that the hauntings wouldn't deter people from coming to enjoy the Vincent house. He told them, quote, "Different people have experienced different things, but to my knowledge, they are a protective spirit of the house, a playful spirit. I have been here 19 years. Yes, I've experienced things, but it doesn't really faze me." And that is the historical yet haunted story of the Vincent house. And our next story isn't really spooky at all, but it's interesting.
Okay. So you have two stories for us.
Lavona and Lavelda Rowe of Iowa City were born November 15th, 1933. Lavona was 6 minutes older than her sister, and by the time they were 13, it was difficult to tell the girls apart. They were identical twins, also known as mirror twins, which means they matched when they looked at each other as if they were looking in a mirror.
Oh, that's cool.
The only way you could tell them apart was if you knew that Lavelda was left-handed and Lavona was right-handed.
That's so cool.
The two were uncannily in tune with each other. They could even finish each other's sentences. Lavona told the Gazette, quote, "In high school, we once were accused of cheating because we gave identical answers in a test. They put us in different rooms. We still had the same answers." Once Lavelda fell down the stairs at school, and when they went to tell Lavona that they were taking her sister to the hospital, Lavona was found unconscious.
Oh.
And according to Unsolved Mysteries, the sisters had their tonsils taken out together, breast biopsies done at the same time, and other major surgeries simultaneously.
Oh.
The twins have also said that they have a strong ESP connection.
Yes.
Typically, twins with ESP, one is usually the receiver and the other the sender. Lavona was the receiver and Lavelda the sender.
How cool. I didn't know that.
Neither did I. In 1952, Lavelda was riding in the car with a young man who had asked her to join him for coffee in town. The man turned in the opposite direction of the coffee shop, and immediately Lavelda knew that something was wrong.
Oh, no.
As the car skidded off the road, Lavona got a strong feeling that something was wrong with Lavelda. Lavona tried to tell her father, but he didn't believe her. He thought she was jealous of the fact that Lavelda was without her. Meanwhile, the car had stopped inches from the water-filled ravine. Lavelda had hit her head on the dashboard, but was not seriously hurt. Thankfully, a farmer helped tow the car out of the ditch into safety. Lavona was relieved when her sister returned home safely. However, their father was still skeptical and asked Lavona to drive to the place where the accident occurred. Within a few minutes, she was able to drive to the crash site, even though she had never been there before. Their father wasn't so skeptical after that.
Yeah, I would never doubt a twin thing.
Yeah.
You know?
So, just fun facts about them. In 1958, they were declared the most identical set of twins of the 5,000 sets of twins in the International Twins Association.
Oh my gosh.
Dr. Philip Clark of Michigan State University, an authority on twins, declared the Rows were, quote, the most identical set of twins I've ever encountered anywhere. The twins were so much alike that people wondered if their fingerprints were the same.
Oh.
The FBI checked and reported, quote, their fingerprints have a similarity of pattern, but they are not identical.
That's cool.
Right? The twins married another set of identical twins.
Oh, my God.
Alwyn and Arthur Richmond in 1976. The brothers were also mirror twins, like Lavona.
Oh, my God.
That was, like, what attracted them.
Oh, of course.
They were like, well, if they take that so seriously, too, they'll like our way of life.
Right.
So the firstborns, Arthur by 15 minutes and Lavona by 6, paired off. And then Lavelda and Alwyn paired off.
Cute.
The brothers even popped the question in unison, saying, we have something we want to ask you.
Oh!
60 set of twins were in attendance, some traveling more than 1,000 miles. Twins were bridesmaids, matrons, and flower girls. One set of twins played the electric organ, and the other supervised the guest book.
Oh, my God.
The four of them honeymooned in Canada together, traveling in the same car, and they all ended up living together in a three-level house in Aurora, Illinois.
Oh, my God.
I did it.
You did it.
Lavona told People magazine, quote, well, want to have a big family in a big hurry. Twins go back 700 years in the boys' family and 600 years in ours.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that insane?
That's wild.
Unfortunately, the couples never had any children.
Oh.
In 1991, Lavelda, Lavona, and Alwyn returned to Iowa City after the passing of Arthur, Lavona's husband. And again in 1977 for the 40th state convention of the Hawkeye Twins Club that the sisters had started as UI students.
Oh.
In 2002, the twins and Alwyn moved to North English, about 30 miles southwest of Iowa City. I love that he still lived with them.
Yeah.
4 years later, Alwyn died.
He is married to one of the twins.
That is true.
Still. I know. I was thinking, well, they went out together. Why did he follow? But he was married to one of them.
He was buried beside his brother in Aurora. Lavelda, the youngest Roe twin, died October 15th, 2009. Lavona would live 10 more years, dying on November 25th, 2019, in Williamsburg at age 86. She is buried beside her sister in North English Cemetery.
Aw.
And that is the strange story of the psychic connected twins in Iowa City.
That's wild.
Isn't that crazy?
Twin stories are so weird.
Yeah. And there was another story that I just thought was really sweet and really cool. It was these, I think another set of twins, but it was fraternal twins. And I guess somehow they got separated along the way, and the brother was trying to put together family tree or whatnot. He was looking for his sister. The episode airs, and she sees it like 3 days later, and they're reunited.
Oh,
I thought that was so sweet.
That is so sweet.
Yeah. So it's crazy how, like, the cases that I've actually been helped by unsolved.
Oh, I know.
I know people, you know, probably chuckle at them, but
I think I gave the statistic when we did our bunk bed and sheds one for Wisconsin.
I think so.
Where it was like some 700 people have been reunited or something like that.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, something weird like that.
I mean, you just never know. It's like the same thing as someone listening to this.
Right.
You know, they could listen to it and hear the story and be like, oh, wait a minute.
I know some information about that.
Exactly. So.
Which is why we like to cover things that people don't always know about.
Exactly. Plus, they're more fun.
They're more fun. Well, thanks for listening.
As always.
Mackenzie and I actually started Only Murders in the Building, so we'll probably go watch an episode or two of that. It's so good.
We have to, because we're done early. We made good timing.
We did make good timing.
So we got to go watch one.
So if you have any fun stories to tell us or...
Oh, speaking of fun stories, not that I have one, but I had a fun idea.
Okay.
That, you know, if you have stories, obviously haunted experience, crazy, whatever. But if you've ever had like an experience with like ESP or premonition or something like that, or you know somebody that did.
Oh my gosh, please.
Those also count as really great stories that we would love to hear. So you should email them to us.
Oh, I have some good premonition stories of grandma.
Yes.
We don't do things if she calls us and says she's worried.
Well, when I was doing this one and thinking of the ESP, that's what made me think of it. And then I thought of your grandma.
Yep. So oh, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
We, like, always get nervous right before a trip. We're scared she's going to call us and be like, so I had a bad feeling. Because there was one time I went to school one day and I was planning on leaving early because there was, like, a pep rally. So I was going to leave early with my boyfriend at the time who was under the age of 18 because we were both under the age of 18. Mm-hmm. And she called me and she was like, hey, like, I don't know what you're planning to do today, but, like, don't get in the car with anyone under the age of 18. And I was like, okay. So when the pep rally came, my boyfriend was like, hey, you ready to go? I said, I'm actually going to stay here today. Nothing happened to him, but I was like, I don't know. Grandma told me she had a bad feeling. I'm staying right here.
You changed the future.
I probably did.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so if you have any of those stories.
Yeah, anything like that is also fully acceptable.
Send them to us at ascarystatepodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, and if you have like... we've been receiving case ideas or stories that we can talk about for different states. So if you have one from the state you're from that you know isn't really well known, you know, isn't talked about a lot.
And or you just want to hear.
You want to hear more about it or whatever. Email us, message us on Instagram. It makes our lives easier because then we don't have to go look for something.
Yeah.
So we
That's how we found out about Spade Cooley. So.
Exactly. Exactly. So we encourage... the suggestions.
Yeah. We got one from one of our good friends.
Yes.
Friend of the show. So yeah. So I guess that's all we have. Yes. So stay scary.
Stay safe.